Chapter 45. As she went up the garden path, she heard her mother singing by the back door, coming in sight of which she perceived Mrs. Durbeyfield on the doorstep in the act of wringing a sheet. Having performed this without observing Tess, she went indoors, and her daughter followed her. The washing tub stood in the same old place on the same old quarter hogshead, and her mother, having thrown the sheet aside, was about to plunge her arms in anew. "Why, Tess, my chill, I thought you was married. Married really and truly this time we sent the cider."
"Yes, mother, so I am."
"Going to be?"
"No, I am married."
"Married? Then where's thy husband?"
"Oh, he's gone away for a time."
"Gone away? When was you married, then?"
"The day you said?"
"Yes, Tuesday, mother."
"And now 'tis on Saturday, and he gone away?"
"Yes, he's gone."
"What's the meaning o' that? Nation sees such husbands as you seem to get, say I."
"Mother." Tess went across to Joan Durbeyfield, laid her face upon the matron's bosom, and burst into sobs.
"I don't know how to tell ye, mother. You said to me, and wrote to me, that I was not to tell him. But I did tell him I couldn't help it and he went away."
"Oh, you little fool, you little fool!" burst out Mrs. Durbeyfield, splashing Tess and herself in her agitation.
"My good God! That ever I should ha' lived to say it, but I say it again, you little fool!"
Tess was convulsed with weeping, the tension of so many days having relaxed at last.
"I know it, I know, I know," she gasped through her sobs.
"But, oh my mother, I could not help it. He was so good, and I felt the wickedness of trying to blind him as to what had happened. If it were to be done again, I should do the same. I could not, I dared not so sin against him.
But you sinned enough to marry him first."
"Yes, yes, that's where my misery do lie. But I thought he could get rid o' me by law, if he were determined not to overlook it. And oh, if you knew, if you could only half know how I loved him, how anxious I was to have him, and how wrung I was between caring so much for him, and my wish to be fair to him." Tess was so shaken, that she could get no further, and sank a helpless thing into a chair.
Well, what's done can't be undone. I'm sure I don't know why children o' my bringing forth should all be bigger simpletons than other people's, not to know better than to blab such a thing as that, when he couldn't ha' found it out till too late.
Here Mrs. Durbeyfield began shedding tears on her own account as a mother to be pitied.
"At your father will say I don't know," she continued, "for he's been talking about the wedding up at Rolliver's, and the pure drop every day since, and about his family getting back to their rightful position through you poor silly man. And now you've made this mess of it. The Lord, a Lord!"
As if to bring matters to a focus, Tess's father was heard approaching at that moment. He did not, however, enter immediately, and Mrs. Durbeyfield said that she would break the bad news to him herself, Tess keeping out of sight for the present. After her first burst of disappointment, Joan began to take the mishap as he had taken Tess's original trouble, as she would have taken a wet holiday or failure in the potato crop, as a thing which had come upon them irrespective of desert or folly, a chance external impingement to be borne with, not a lesson. Tess retreated upstairs, and beheld casually that the beds had been shifted, and new arrangements made. Her old bed had been adapted for two younger children. There was no place here for her now. The room below being unsealed, she could hear most of what went on there. Presently her father entered, apparently carrying in a live hen. He was a foot haggler now, having been obliged to sell his second horse, and he traveled with his basket on his arm. The hen had been carried about this morning as it was often carried, to show people that he was in his work, though it had lain, with its legs tied, under the table at Rolliver's for more than an hour. "We've just had up a story about Durbeyfield," began, and thereupon related in detail to his wife a discussion which had arisen at the inn about the clergy, originated by the fact of his daughter having married into a clerical family.
Tide was formerly styled Sir, like my own ancestry, he said, though nowadays their true style, strictly speaking, is clerk only. As Tess had wished that no great publicity should be given to the event, he had mentioned no particulars. He hoped she would remove that prohibition soon. He proposed that the couple should take Tess's own name, D'Urberville, as uncorrupted. It was better than her husband's. He asked if any letter had come from her that day. Then Mrs. D'Urberville informed him that no letter had come, but Tess unfortunately had come herself. When at length the collapse was explained to him, a sullen mortification, not usual with D'Urberville, overpowered the influence of the cheering glass. Yet the intrinsic quality of the event moved his touchy sensitiveness less than its conjectured effect upon the minds of others. To think, now, that this was to be the end of, said Sir John. And I with a family vault under that there church of Kingsbere as big as Squire Jollard's ale cellar, and my folk lying there in sixes and sevens, as genuine county bones and marrow as any recorded in history. And now to be sure, what they fellers at Rolliver's and the Pure Drop will say to me. How they'll squint and glain, and say, this is yer mighty match is it. This is yer getting back to the true level of yer forefathers in King Norman's time. I feel this is too much. Joan, I shall put an end to myself, title and all, I can bear it no longer. But she can make him keep her, if he's married her? Why, yes. But she won't think o' doing that. Do you think he really have married her, or is it like the first, poor Tess, who had heard as far as this, could not bear to hear more? The perception that her word could be doubted even here, in her own parental house, set her mind against the spot as nothing else could have done. How unexpected were the attacks of destiny! And if her father doubted her a little, would not neighbors and acquaintance doubt her much? Oh, she could not live long at home. A few days, accordingly, were all that she allowed herself here, at the end of which time she received a short note from Claire, informing her that he had gone to the north of England, to look at a farm. In her craving for the luster of her true position as his wife, and to hide from her parents the vast extent of the division between them, she made use of this letter as her reason for again departing, leaving them under the impression that she was setting out to join him. Still further to screen her husband from any imputation on unkindness to her, she took 25 of the £50 Claire had given her, and handed the sum over to her mother, as if the wife of a man like Angel Claire could well afford it, saying that it was a slight return for the trouble and humiliation as he had brought upon them in years past. With this assertion of her dignity she bade them farewell. And after that there were lively doing in the D'Urberville household for some time on the strength of Tess's bounty, her mother saying, and, indeed, believing, that the rupture which had arisen between the young husband and wife had adjusted itself under their strong feeling that they could not live apart from each other. XXXIX, it was 3 weeks after the marriage, that Claire found himself descending the hill which led to the well-known parsonage of his father. With his downward course the tower of the church rose into the evening sky in a manner of inquiry as to why he had come, and no living person in the twilighted town seemed to notice him, still less to expect him. He was arriving like a ghost, and the sound of his own footsteps was almost an encumbrance to be got rid of. The picture of life had changed for him. Before this time he had known it but speculatively. Now he thought he knew it as a practical man, though perhaps he did not, even yet. Nevertheless humanity stood before him no longer in the pensive sweetness of Italian art, but in the staring and ghastly attitudes of a Wiertz museum, and with the leer of a study by Van Beers. His conduct during these first weeks had been desultory beyond description. After mechanically attempting to pursue his agricultural plans, as though nothing unusual had happened, in the manner recommended by the great and wise men of all ages, he concluded that very few of those great and wise men had ever gone so far outside themselves as to test the feasibility of their counsel. This is the chief thing. Be not perturbed, said the pagan moralist. That was just Claire's own opinion. But he was perturbed. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid, said the Nazarene. Claire chimed in cordially, but his heart was troubled all the same. How he would have liked to confront those two great thinkers, and earnestly appeal to them as fellow man to fellow men, and ask them to tell him their method. His mood transmuted itself into a dogged indifference till at length he fancied he was looking on his own existence with the passive interest of an outsider. He was embittered by the conviction that all this desolation had been brought about by the accident of her being a d'Urberville. When he found that Tess came of that exhausted ancient line, and was not of the new tribes from below, as he had fondly dreamed, why had he not stoically abandoned her, in fidelity to his principles? This was what he had got by apostasy, and his punishment was deserved. Then he became weary and anxious, and his anxiety increased. He wondered if he had treated her unfairly. He ate without knowing that he ate, and drank without tasting. As the hours dropped past, as the motive of each act in the long series of bygone days presented itself to his view, he perceived how intimately the notion of having Tess as a dear possession was mixed up with all his schemes and words and ways. In going hither and thither he observed in the outskirts of a small town a red and blue placard setting forth the great advantages of the Empire of Brazil as a field for the emigrating agriculturist. Land was offered there on exceptionally advantageous terms. Brazil somewhat attracted him as a new idea. Tess could eventually join him there, and perhaps in that country of contrasting scenes and notions and habits the conventions would not be so operative which made life with her seem impracticable to him here. In brief, he was strongly inclined to try Brazil, especially as the season for going thither was just at hand. With this view he was returning to Emminster, to disclose his plan to his parents, and to make the best explanation he could make of arriving without Tess, short of revealing what had actually separated them. As he reached the door the new moon shone upon his face, just as the old one had done in the small hours of that morning, when he had carried his wife in his arms across the river to the graveyard of the monks, but his face was thinner now. Claire had given his parents no warning of his visit, and his arrival stirred the atmosphere of the vicarage as the dive of the kingfisher stirs a quiet pool. His father and mother were both in the drawing room, but neither of his brothers was now at home. Angel entered, and closed the door quietly behind him. "But where's your wife, dear Angel?" cried his mother. "How you surprise us." "She is at her mother's temporarily. I have come home rather in a hurry, because I've decided to go to Brazil." "Brazil? Why, they are all Roman Catholics there, surely." "Are they? I hadn't thought of that." But even the novelty and painfulness of his going to a papistical land could no displace for long Mr. and Mrs. Clare's natural interest in their son's marriage. "We had your brief note 3 weeks ago announcing that it had taken place," said Mrs. Clare, "and your father sent your godmother's gift to her, as you know. Of course it was best that none of us should be present." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.